Instead of our usual silly cold open, we want to take 30 seconds to publicly state that we here at Monsters and Multiclass support the Black Lives Matter movement and stand with those calling for an end to the police brutality and systemic racism that has gripped America. Please use your voice to speak out against injustices, engage in politics both at the local and national level, march in protest, sign petitions, and if you are able, donate to organizations fighting for the cause. Thank you. Welcome to Monsters and Multiclass, your Dungeons & Dragons fix. I'm Kevin Odie.
I'm Jared Bornigal.
And I'm Will Meldon.
And we'll be hanging out with you for a while to talk about anything and everything D&D related. This episode, we're diving into the new book, The Mythic Odyssey of Theros. Specifically, we'll be looking at some new character creation options in the form of supernatural gifts, new races, and subclass options. And in addition, we'll be looking at one of the new mythic monsters from the back of the book. So pull up a chair and stick around for a while.
All right, so to start off here, just wanted to say that we were going to have an episode with Horimir, a friend of the show, but he was unable to join us this week, so we plan on having him back on for another time. But if you were confused why we were talking about this today instead of paladins and rangers, that's the reason. So to start things off, this book that we're talking about today, Mythic Odysseys of Theros, is a new setting book. Set in a kind of Greek mythology type world. As I understand, it is a Magic the Gathering setting that none of us here are terribly familiar with. But there's a lot of good mechanic stuff in here, and also great lore to pick and choose, put into your own setting, even if you don't plan on using the book in its entirety, which I definitely don't plan on doing because entire setting books are a lot to read, and I don't have time for that. And if you don't have time for that, then you can just listen to us talk about the mechanics and what's cool about it. We're just doing all the work for you. Aren't you so lucky? All right, so starting off here, we're going to take a look at the supernatural gifts. So these are very similar to the DM just letting every player take a feat at level one, which is very common practice that I see, especially around getting rid of the variant human that a lot of DMs don't like. These, though, are different. I mean, they don't just take from feats directly. It has an optional rule in there to just use feats if you'd like to. But the overall idea is just that it's like a feat. Starting off here, first thoughts on this concept, Kevin and Will.
Overall, I definitely like the concept. It's really going to, especially at early levels, I think, kind of boost the power level of the party. And DMs are going to need to adjust accordingly. There are some really strong options in here. But overall, I love the flavor. I mean, I always love more customization options for characters, especially when they're official. And this is just a really flavorful way to do it, especially in a world that is really heavy on the gods' kind of interactions with the world.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that the what you said of the DM needs to balance around this and kind of be prepared for it, very, very true. I also get the feeling that that's the point of the setting, is you are all heroes and you are supposed to be these crazy badasses that legends will be told of your tales for lifetimes to come. So throwing in options like this, I think, are very in line with how a lot of people kind of play the game already. But it's putting a good way to codify it. Will, any first thoughts?
I like the concept. I've always liked the concept of defeatifying feats. Feats are an optional rule that became mandatory in a lot of people's minds, and the way that they're gone about, it puts a lot of hard limitations. But I also have the mentality of, you know, not exactly what you just said.
Right.
You know, the obvious inspiration that everyone will know is Achilles here. Achilles was dipped in the river, held by the heel. That's why when he took an arrow to the Achilles tendon, blah, 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 he died. That's like in this as an example.
As one of the gifts? What do you
mean?
Yeah,
they mentioned it in the heroic feats. Like, okay, you were bathed in the waters of Mystic, now you're tough.
Right.
Achilles was like the greatest of all greats. And now you have like an entire party of like wannabe Achilles.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm always of the like, your backstory should be you wanted to be a town guard, but your town got killed. You know, your dad was a town guard. You studied at wizard school. End of story.
Right.
You're like the 12,005th most powerful person in the realm.
Right.
Sit down, buddy. But, you know, I totally get why people don't play that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right. As I say, this is not everybody likes to play that kind of down-to-earth, a little more realistic feeling
game. Gritty D&D, in the sense that it's just boring.
To just kind of give an example of what these are, we'll start with the first one here, Anvil Rot, saying you were forged in the fires by a... Oh boy, I really should practice on pronunciation of all these different gods' names. There's like 17 of them, and they're all weird.
Perforos.
Perforos? Perforos?
Yeah.
So you're forged in the fires of Perforos' forge.
Or how about just a disclaimer, just to start here. So normally D&D Beyond will have little pronunciation guides, but it looks like we got to the book a little too early. So if we mispronounce anything, that's because we're not linguists. We're here to talk about Dungeons & Dragons. Go on, Kevin, with confidence.
All right. Perforos' forge, your appearance bears metallic sheen and visible joints. In a sense, this kind of is almost making you a warforged without picking the race of warforged.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these come with different, benefits and perks. So specifically if you're Anvil Rot, you get constructed resilience. You were created to have remarkable fortitude, presented by the following benefits. You have advantage against being poisoned and resistance to poison damage. Stay can right from being a dwarf, but oh well. You don't need to eat, drink, or breathe. You're immune to disease, and you don't sleep at night. And magic can't put you to sleep. And then you also get sentry's rest. When you take a long rest, you must spend at least 6 hours in an inactive, motionless state rather than sleeping. In this state, you appear inert, but it doesn't render you unconscious and get seen here as normal.
Yeah, this is definitely what you want to have if you have to take any watches at all in your game. If you have somebody like this in there, it's just like they're basically constantly on watch.
Yep. Yep, much is taken care of. Yeah, like I said, it just kind of makes you a warforged without being a warforged.
Which is kind of nice, because you can still then take all of the other racial benefits. Maybe you like what being a halfling gives you, because you want to have that re-rolling ones and everything else. But you still have a great idea for a kind of warforged background. This is like a simple way to do that. You can also just kind of say that you're a cyborg. Like, if we want to look at taking these out and using them as feats, not any game that we're playing right now or like any worlds that we're using, but I could very easily see just using this and being like, yes, I am now a cyborg, whatever the heck I am, and that's the feat I took.
Right. A cyborg warforged.
I think this would be pretty pointless to take if you're already warforged.
Yes. Is warforged actually official?
Yeah, it's an Eberron. Yeah.
It is? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't remember if it made it into a book or it was just kind of one of those little side things that everyone treats as official, but okay.
No, it is. I don't know how I feel about the race, but that's not what we're here to talk about today.
Right. And then all of these also have a kind of a table of quirks. This one, like the Anvil Rot characteristics. It's a D6. You roll on it. Obviously, you can pick which one you want or mix them up. These are things like an Oread who works in... Perforos' forge is the closest thing I have to a parent, or they say his name too much. Perforos regrets my creation, wants to reforge me into something better. It's stuff like that, just different quirks and stuff. Yeah, there's 9 of these in total, so good ways to add flavor and characteristics. I don't think we need to go through all of them in detail, but I do feel there's a really big difference between some of them in within their benefit. So, like, Anvil Rot's pretty solid. It has good both in-combat and out-of-combat utility with the sentry's rest and not needing to eat or sleep and then being immune to disease and resistance to poison and all that's obviously really great and helpful. The next one down, Heroic Destiny, which is pretty self-explanatory what that means. You have advantage on death-saving throws, and when you are reduced to 0 hit points but not killed outright, you could drop to 1 instead. You could use this once per long rest. Both of those abilities are amazing.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's...
They also step the fuck all over, you know, multiple class features.
Yeah.
Yes.
We've also got a racial feature. There's just, like, a lot of overlap here.
Yeah, so, yeah, you have one. It's just, like, almost a universally good pick. Anybody will benefit from that. And then go down to inscrutable, where it's... Actually, this is kind of fitting, because we talked about sphinxes last time, where your mind's kind of like a sphinx, or you're trained by a sphinx, and you have resistance to psychic damage, which doesn't come up much. And you are immune to effects to read your emotions, and there's disadvantage on insight checks to read you. It just feels like it's on a completely different level.
Yeah, no, very much so. And one thing more about Heroic Destiny, the hard to kill, which is when you're reduced to 0 HP but not killed, you can drop to 1 HP instead. If you were also a half-orc, you would get both of those. So you would basically get two times where you can drop to 0 and drop to 1 instead.
Jeez. And then be a barbarian. And there's what the Zealot Barbarian, I think, has a... And a Zealot Barbarian would be super fitting for this.
Yeah. World,
probably.
Yeah.
So I think you got three options then.
Yeah, you kind of got to be careful with that one. And with the races given in this book specifically, which I think to some extent that is the expectation here, is that if you're using this book, you're going to use everything in the confines of this one rule book. There's no, I guess, racial overlap there. There's, I guess, Zealot Barbarians are still a thing. That would make sense. But they just have the Rage Beyond Death, don't they? Or is that all Barbarians?
Zealot Barbarians have something where they keep fighting.
Yeah, well, either way.
They have like an unlimited death pool where they just don't die.
Right, right. So,
but I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Whereas if you came in with like you look at these, and when I looked these over, they seem like a lot of racial traits replacing races that aren't in this setting. So I kind of wonder if that was the goal.
Could be. Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Zealot Barbarian, yeah, Rage Beyond Death, it's the Zealot Barbarian. It's 14th level. While you're raging and hit 0 hit points, you aren't unconscious.
Okay.
So it actually almost makes that other stuff obsolete. Because by the time you're 14th level, you're pretty much always raging in a fight.
Right. Yeah, so Heroic Destiny is seeming a little bit, a little too strong there. I liked Lifelong Companion. That one was at least, it was nothing too crazy strong, it wasn't too weak, but the boon aura is just your allies within 5 feet of you have advantage on saving throws against being frightened or charmed, provided you aren't incapacitated. It's a lot like paladin auras very often follow that.
Mm-hmm.
But then companion's protection, when a creature you can see within 5 feet of you is hit by an attack roll, you can use your reaction to cause the attack to hit you instead. Once you use this trait, you can't do so again until you finish a long rest. I wish that one could be used a little bit more often. I feel like one time is really not worthwhile. But that does come into one good way to use that is if you know what the roll was. Yeah, it was like a 17 and it hits against your AC 15 druid and you have it hit you who's got like full plate and everything. So that the attack then misses. That would be kind of nice. But I'm not sure entirely if it works like that. Just because it says the attack hits you instead. So does it automatically hit if it was a hit before? Or does it make the attack roll be against you instead?
I think it hits you. Yeah, because it doesn't say when a creature makes a, within 5 feet of you, makes an attack roll, you can use your reaction to have the attack target you.
Mm.
It's when a creature's hit, you can make it hit you instead.
Okay, well then I take it back. This one's just not that great either. And as I'm seeing it now, anybody who picks anything besides Heroic Destiny almost looks a little bit silly. And, I mean, that's... To some extent, that's fine, at least that all of these are only mediocre, because I think that there's something interesting about them, at the very least, that you can give people, they can play to. But when you do have one that's extremely overpowered in comparison... Then one person takes that and everybody else takes the mediocre ones. It makes one character potentially shine a little bit more.
Keep in mind, that's really only a combat benefit, though. Outside of combat, they get nothing. We're saying, like, Iconoclast, which is... And I like the inclusion of this one. It's one where if you're saying they're... You're not... You're kind of rejecting the gods. You're not denying their existence, but don't feel they deserve your worship. You could be an iconoclast. And you end up learning spells and stuff as you go further on. So like right away, you get protection from evil and good. Fifth level, you get the spell magic. 11th, dispel evil and good. In addition, you can upcast your dispel magic as fourth level. 17th level, you get anti-magic field. And all of these are once per day casting.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's really solid stuff.
It is. I will agree with that.
Once a day, dispel magic.
I'll say this one also, though, has to be... It's kind of trying to combine two things into one, though. This is your supernatural gift, and it's replacing piety, which is something else that this book added that we weren't planning on spending too much time on, but it is basically a way to gain favor with your gods and earn gifts in the form of usually spells or other miscellaneous boons. So this iconoclast does not have the ability to gain piety. And if they don't, then they are not getting those benefits. So this is really now you don't have a good supernatural gift, and you're replacing what your piety options would have been.
That is true, but are any of them better than... This seems like a really strong list.
It is.
Of spells you get.
I think it's pretty good, but the fact that all of the piety options have at 50 piety, you get plus 2 to your... to a stat that you want, depending on the god you go down. I don't think any spell is going to really compete with that.
I don't know. Anti-magic field's pretty nice.
Okay, yeah, I guess that's a pretty... If one's going to compete with it, anti-magic field's there.
Yeah.
You also have to read into the second kind of implication with that, is you don't lose piety either. And
that's true.
It's not as explicit there, but there is the almost idea behind it where you'll be forced to make choices where you lose piety and there may be negative repercussions to pissing off your god. So making somebody immune to that, it's kind of interesting.
Okay,
right.
That's fair.
And then it just offers an avenue for role-playing for someone who wants to play a character that is not all about the gods of this world.
Oh, totally. Role-playing wise, I think it's fantastic. I also really liked the Oracle one.
Mm-hmm.
Where just the entire concept is you're an oracle for a specific god, and this also replaces piety, but instead follows the same kind of pathway. It just, whatever the normal path would be for that god is replaced with the oracle one, and a lot of it just falls around the divination realm. With 3, you get to cast Augury as a ritual once per long rest. Seer, you can cast divination as a ritual once per long rest, then commune, and then after you can increase your intelligence or wisdom. But being able to cast commune literally every day for free is really, really useful, because that's the spell that lets you just ask your deity something, like 3 questions that could be answered yes or no. And that's a lot of power in a player's hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you cast every day? Doesn't it say something you can't use it again for... like a week?
Once you do so, you can't cast it in this way again until you finish a long rest. That's definitely a time where the specific trumps the general.
Very true. Okay.
And also you can't be surprised as long as you're not incapacitated, which is, just a nice little benefit.
Yeah, the Oracle should not be surprised very often.
Yeah.
Yeah, they also get Oracle's Insight, which is this, they get this right away from the beginning, where when you make an ability check, you could roll a d10 and add that number to the roll. It's a once per short or long rest ability.
Yeah, and that's just really nice. I love that.
Right. Oracles also have curses. This is more of just a role-playing thing, but these are items where, and again, there's a d8 table. This is their kind of quirks to choose from. Items like, I know exactly when I'm going to die, and I can't do or say anything to prevent it. Anytime I grow close to someone, I see them aged, dying, or dead. Whenever I receive a divine vision, I get an intense pain in my head or chest. Different things like that. That first one, though, I know exactly when I'm going to die, and I can't do or say anything to prevent it. I feel like that's a really weird one to put in there for a D&D character. Because they could just die. Like, you might play it out where there's this grand destiny, and they know they're destined to sacrifice themselves for the greater good of the realm much later on in life, and the goblin gets a good roll at level 2 and they die.
I would say it's more of, as the player, you would have to be very cryptic about it, which kind of sucks to some extent, but you just have to be like, I know when I'm going to die. I know what, my time is. And when it happens is when you get to then say, told y'all, I knew this was going to happen. I couldn't say anything because, I can't talk about it, but I knew this was going to happen.
Well, yeah, you can't talk about it because you're fucking dead.
No, with your dying words, you basically just say, as it was foretold. Like, really?
Everybody in the world literally can do this.
I know.
Like,
I know.
In real life.
I understand that.
Oh, I have superpowers. I knew this was going to happen. Grandma, you've been in hospice for 4 years. You say this every time we visit. Come on. It's not an oracle power. And you're right, it's like stepping all over the legitimate mechanical realities of the game. And I think a lot of this, like, that's kind of why I've always said these backstories, like the unepic backstories, always appeal more to me, because at level one you can just get murked by a goblin, like, for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
You're not the chosen of Perforos, you're not this grand oracle. You're a dude who just took an arrow to the neck on his third of Gendron.
Very true. Unscarred's another one where I feel like it's just kind of really weak. Both in roleplay implications and mechanical. The idea is that you're resilient to physical harm. Like, you were bathed in Hydra's blood as an infant. You swallowed a magical stone. When you were a child, like, God, heal me. And now wombs are reluctant to undo God's work. Like, all that stuff's kind of cool. But it manifests itself as when you take damage, you can use your reaction to roll a d12. Add your constitution modifier and reduce the damage by the total. You can do this once for short and rest.
Wow.
It's like, it's not that much.
No, it's really not that much.
I mean, I guess at level one, sure. But like, as you get higher, it's just like, it doesn't level with you.
At most, you're reducing 17, but on average, you're reducing 11 damage once you have that 5 constitution.
And who gets 5 constitution?
Yeah, it's not.
Goliaths.
This is not.
Who also have this trait?
Do they?
Yeah. I mean, this is stolen from the Goliath stat block, too.
Okay, well, I guess having it twice would be cool.
To slightly make up for the already mediocre racial stat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like they needed something else.
They also do the thing where they, like, step directly all over the mechanical realities of a game. With, like, the first one. I was bathed in Hydra's blood as an infant, and my wounds closed too quickly to become mortal injuries. They really don't.
Until they do.
They super... No. They yeah. don't. They will not do that. You will die.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, it's... I think to some extent you can use flavor to excuse mechanics a little bit, but this is making very, very strong claims. It seems more of what people would say about you if they were telling tall tales. You know, like if the bard was singing your praise, yeah. They would say, oh, this great person was bathed in the Hydra's blood as an infant. Their wounds immediately heal up. I watched them do it. Every time they're attacked, the wounds just close immediately. And it's like, well, no, you just caught him at his one good time per short rest. That don't expect him to keep doing that. You can't just stab the guy all day.
Just ruining bardic right. tales.
Yeah. That's the bard character that I want to play. It's the lore bard who goes around and disproves other bard stories.
The lore...
just goes around like...
The hardcore lore bard?
Yeah.
Actually.
That's not how it happened at all.
What you think of as supernatural is a very, very describable mechanic.
What's a mechanic?
In practice, it's much weaker than normal choices. One has to question why his parents let him choose that.
I do want to talk about Nyxborn. I'm hoping I'm saying that right. NYX.
Sure.
Born. Nyxborn, whatever. Another one of these. The Nyxborn is, it's a fragment of divinity. It's an idea or a dream that is incarnate. Your body... You embody an idea. And then the Nyx, or the Nyx, is a concept within this book. There's a whole section of a chapter dedicated to it, so we won't dive into it. I don't fully understand it, to be honest. But you get Cloak of Stars. As an action, you wrap yourself in a starry cloak, appearing like a silhouette formed of the night sky. When you do, attack rolls have disadvantage against you. It lasts for a minute, or until you doff it, or until you die. You can use this once per long rest. I mean, I think that's awesome. Okay. It's flavorful. It's going to look cool as hell, and disadvantage against you for a minute once per day is great.
Yeah, and the fact that on top of that you also get resistance to necrotic and radiant damage, that's just, right. It's just good.
Yeah. I also really like the Nyxborn quirks. This stuff like, my hair moves as if in perpetual breeze. My anger smells like burning autumn leaves. When the sun shines on me just so, I glimmer with many colors. Just fun, quirky shit to add to your character.
It is. Once again, though, like the more that I think about this, it sounds like the stuff that bards talk about and not what's actually happening. I mean, that's fine if you actually want it to be that when you get angry, it smells like burning autumn leaves. That's all right. Every time it comes up, it's going to sound a little, I don't know, lame, to be honest. I don't know.
It's kind of, it sounds like middle school poetry a little bit.
I mean, the burning autumn leaves one's a little high.
That one.
A little specific.
My hair moves in a...
Oh, the rest of them.
My hair moves in a perpetual breeze. I mean, I don't know. It's one of those things that, like, if somebody came to the table, and it taking a step back, I recognize that it is different because this is the setting. That's what the setting does, is it's blowing things out of proportion, and that's fine. But if somebody came to a normal table and described their character, and one of the things they use to describe them is that their hair appears to be blowing in a perpetual breeze, I would... kind of recoil a little bit here. Like, they're one of those kinds of players.
I guess, yeah, like in your low fantasy world, yes, that would be out of place and weird. In Theros, it fits.
It totally fits.
It does.
And that's the ones that I do like. There's still people who sleep near me always dream of the sea. I could see that coming up. Just kind of be like an interesting thing when the party first gets together, as the DM night after night describes all of your dreams being oddly sea related. And then everybody's kind of like, hey, did you dream of the sea last night? And it's like, yeah, this is like the sixth time this week. And just like kind of an interesting quirk that I could see. And then the person's like, oh yeah, that happens to everybody near me. That's part of being a Nyxborn.
Yeah, I feel like there's some deeper lore of the Nyx that explains that we don't know. But
or it's just the D6 table and they came up with a bunch of random stuff.
All right, we said we weren't going to talk about all of these, but there's literally one left, so let's just talk about
it. Okay.
The Pious, which is... you're born with a particular connection to a deity, and you're very pious. You have pious protection. If you fail a saving throw, you can re-roll it. Must use the new roll. You can once per long rest. Religious study, you have advantage on in religion checks pertaining to your god. And then your starting piety is 3 with your chosen god.
All right. Pious protection, I love that. Being able to re-roll a saving throw once per long rest is a very, very useful trait.
Yes.
Religious study, having advantage on religion checks pertaining to your chosen god, I, to some extent, feel like that's a normal DM discretion, where, like, I'm going to give advantage anyways. Like, maybe I'm thinking from a cleric perspective, where, like, if there's a cleric in my game and they follow a specific god and they were making a religion check to recall their lore, that's when I say, oh, you would be really good at this, or I just give it to them. So,
right.
This one seems really good. It seems fitting. I just feel like the way that I normally play, it's not that worthwhile.
Right. But it's nice to kind of have it codified in there.
I'm not going to argue that.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with, like, the acolyte background's another one. If you're like an acolyte of X, Y, or Z god, anything you do with that, like, come on. That is the time the DM should give advantage.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
This is my thing. Come on. Like, nope, sorry, the wizard who chose the supernatural gift pious is actually better at this than you are, sorry.
It's an in-based skill.
They have a higher intelligence, they have this advantage on the roll. Yeah, whatever, that's not important.
This goes back to why you should, like, put a auto success in your head with a lot of skill checks. Is the 20 strength barbarian trying to break down a DC 15 door? Guess what he shouldn't roll?
He shouldn't roll a religion check. That wouldn't make sense.
Shouldn't roll anything.
Oh.
Door's fucked, man.
No, I'm with you there. But yeah, I mean, overall, though, I think that they do add... all of these supernatural gifts, beyond Heroic Destiny, I think all add just enough. Heroic Destiny, I worry, is a little strong, but everything else is cool, it's interesting, it might be something that DMs who are currently giving, you know, everybody a feat may want to use this instead. I could very easily see going down that path. And if everyone's choosing kind of the, I don't want to say mediocre ones, but the ones that aren't, you know, overwhelming, then it's just neat and kind of can help you flesh out who your character is.
And actually, thinking back on Heroic Destiny, I might have been a little too harsh on it about how powerful it is. If you think on it further, it's not really helping in combat. It just helps you not die. You don't hit harder. You're not harder to hit. You don't have more health. You don't have more spells or overpowered abilities. It just, if you were to go down, it will not stick as much as with other people. I mean, it's advantage at death saving throws. The enemy can keep hacking away at you and kill you very easily. If you drop to zero, you go to one is obviously very strong. But as we said, you could pick races that give that ability at level one as well. So there's obviously, it's not completely unprecedented.
Yeah.
And then it kind of gives you an excuse to, and a little confidence to play that really foolhardy character that keeps trying these ridiculous gambits and just throwing themselves in harm's way. No, and they just always seem to come through anyways. Even if it screws up and everyone else has to save them, they're still kind of coming through.
See, everyone? I told you it would work. It's like you died in the second round. Yeah, but then I was stable.
Yep.
Yeah, I appreciate that they didn't add anything too silly. There's no pole arm master here, so.
I mean, it does say that, like, you know, work with your DM. That's like the entire heroic feats thing, is maybe you just want to give feats instead. Kind of give some ways to go for that. But no, it does not discuss pole arm master as one of the options.
Specifically, if somebody comes to the table asking for free pole arm master, tell them to go home.
But my god is the god of poles.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'd give it to them then. But, like, you know, a more accurate one or more believable one is if somebody wanted sharpshooter and they had a god who was specifically devoted to archery. It's like, hunting. Yeah, sure. It's like, okay, I guess I can kind of see it. But at the same time, I don't want you to do that. I mean, but does it make them feel more like they were born into that hunter role? If so, then it's cool, it's interesting, it's a feat that's already available through Variant Human and going that direction. It's just explaining it as a birthright.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess to some extent, if the flavor can be there, I'm not going to argue it too much, but I'm also never going to use these anyways.
The safest position to be in.
But there are some ways that other people can. If you want to use the Great Weapon Master, or is it, which one is it? What's the one that gives you -5 and +10? I always mix it up between Great Weapon Master and Great Weapon Fighter. They're like too similar.
I think Master. Great Weapon Fighter is the fighting style,
okay.
I think.
Okay, well then yeah, maybe you want Great Weapon Master. You've got a god who's a war god. That seems pretty fitting to me. Mm-hmm. So there are options.
Yeah. Yeah, no, overall, I like these. As we kind of talked about, we're very much on a kick right now, sort of low fantasy. We're not the saviors of the realm. We're just kind of doing our own crap in our games. And so these don't fit. But I could see in the future if we do a little kind of side thing and we really want to play like big heroic characters doing mythic battles and stuff like that, adding in supernatural gifts.
Which I think has been proven time and time again. We are on the outskirts there. At the very least, with what Wizards of the Coast mm-hmm. keeps putting out, this is the way people are playing. This is the way people want to play. And obviously, that's completely fine. You know, our opinions are still going to be affected by that to some extent, though. And Will's idea of you shouldn't even have levels. Nobody should level up. You'll just stay level one and you die, unless you survive, in which case you're the greatest badass of all.
No, you should have to play the experience of the average person. You should go through 10 level ones before your first one survives and becomes a level 2 hero. At which point, you go through the filter again. By your 900th character, you might be level 6.
Sounds like a blast.
I mean, there is something that sounds kind of cool about that.
Does it?
Kind of, yes. Maybe not.
In theory, yeah. In practice, not at all.
No, yeah. That sounds like it'd be terrible to play. You're just going to be using randomly generated characters.
Yes. No, you don't need to randomly generate them because you are stuck with this, like, the lowest of low fantasy. You've got like 40 farmers just lined up. Just change their name a tiny bit. There's no stat differences. There's no background differences. Your dad was a farmer. Your mom was a farmer. Their dad and mom were a farmer. You're a farmer. It's It's so easy.
Yeah, never mind. You lost me. Because then what's the point? What's dying even mean then?
It means that you weren't meant to be a hero.
Oh, so I guess Thaddeus wasn't meant to be, but Chattius is, so.
Exactly. That's how it actually works, kind of. I don't know.
Kind of, I guess. All right.
I think it's time to move on to the races.
Yes. So on to the races. The first one is humans. Very, very interesting. They are the same as humans in every other book possible. But I think they're just letting us know that humans do exist in Theros.
Check.
Next. On to centaurs. They did change a good amount from centaurs. Doesn't seem as though they're... Are they rideable anymore? Because they're now considered medium. And they don't have anything that specifies they're rideable. Except for... They're considered a size category larger for their carrying capacity. And that was one thing in the UA when they were released, is everyone's like, so you can just ride these. I guess you still could have like the halfling or gnomes, any small creatures can officially still ride them because they are medium.
Don't let your players play a centaur.
In this world, it makes sense though.
Yeah. They're pretty integral to Theros. Yeah, strength plus 2, wisdom and 1.
Then speed is 40.
Yeah, size category, medium. Speed is 40, which is nice. I think that makes them the fastest.
It does, yeah.
Actually, that's a bold statement. There's a lot of obscure races in all the different books, so I can't say that with confidence. But you're fey instead of humanoid.
Oh, that's really nice, actually. Because there's a lot of... What does that change? So does hold person work against you? It doesn't. It'd have to be hold monster.
Mm. Yep.
I wonder what other areas that affects.
A shitload, honestly.
Yeah, probably a good amount. There's a lot of spells where it's target and abilities that target humanoid. But there's also ones that specifically target fey, like fey, fiend, undead.
Right. So you just, as the DM, just put in some paladins. No, that doesn't work against fey. Smites are against fiends and undead. Never mind.
Yeah. But like protection from good and evil, fey's and that.
Okay. They do have a charge ability, which is something that monsters generally have, but they can move 30 feet in a straight line towards a target and then hit it with a melee weapon attack and then use their bonus action to make a additional attack with their hooves, which are natural weapons, count as unarmed strikes that do 1d4 plus your strength modifier. And what type of damage? They deal bludgeoning damage instead of the normal bludgeoning damage. Yep. Okay, the wording confused me there. So... That's nice. I mean, I just like that. It makes sense for a centaur to have a charge ability.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the most important thing is their equine build. That's what I mentioned earlier. They count as one size larger when determining carrying capacity and the weight you can push or drag. Also, it's very difficult for them to climb things. So each foot of movement costs 4 extra feet instead of the normal 1 extra foot. So they have... double difficult terrain on any incline or any, I guess, climbing at all.
Any incline is not the right
thing. No, it's not. It's not. any like even...
Oh, look, an incredibly easy to scale hill. You're dead. You will not survive this.
Even just like a 178 degrees. It's like, that's too much.
Yeah.
Rope ladders. It's meant for like ladders and ropes.
Right.
Imagine how hard it would be to do pull-ups as a centaur.
That's a lot.
It's actually, yeah. It's almost kind of ridiculous to climb ladders and ropes at all. It should just be like, you can't. If it is a climbing check needed, you can't do it.
Roll a new character.
I would almost add that on, is that any skill check that you have to do for climbing should be made at disadvantage. And that might just be something that kind of comes up at the table, but like, you know, if you put in we had an entire thing in our game that was about climbing the side of a mountain. If you guys had a centaur, they would have just failed. That's it. Like, you can't do it.
No, we tie a harness around them, pulley at the top and just hoist them up. I mean, yeah. They're just kind of dangling, their arms limp, looking sad. I shouldn't have been a centaur.
They do get proficiency in... one of the following skills: animal handling, medicine, nature, or survival. All good skills. I don't know. I like getting skills for my race. Yeah. That's always nice.
Yeah. No, these aren't like amazingly good, but they're fine. I think they'd probably make decent barbarians. Because you got plus two strength and then the wisdom
extra
and stuff like charge.
Yeah, the charge would be really nice because then they can get the rage damage on that too.
Right. Certain clerics, melee clerics, forge clerics, war clerics, stuff like that, where they will actually utilize that two strength, but they also get the wisdom.
Horse monk.
Controversial take. You have to spend four times as much on your armor.
I was about to say, as far as I could tell, there's nothing written in here about armor. I don't think I missed that.
Oof. But making it follow horse armor rules is kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
I could see a monk, just because it sounds really funny to me. I know that they're strength and wisdom, so it's not like the best stat build here. But a horse monk is, that's like a 10 out of 10 character right there.
Right. A strength ranger.
Also completely fine. You know? It's not a karate horse, but yeah, I mean, it's good.
Yeah. They get go the Beastmaster route, get an animal companion that's also a horse.
Ooh, no, get an animal companion that's like a
actually I don't think you can
that's but... like a small creature, and have your animal companion ride on top of you.
Ah, there we go. Okay.
Who's really the jockey here?
All right, so that's Centaurus. Next on the list, Leonin.
Leonins.
Lionin. Lionin. Leonin.
L E. Yeah. Where are you getting that sound from at all?
I don't know, man. I'm not good with
Leonin, yes. The bigger, stronger, cooler tabaxis.
Yep. Lion people.
So their ability score increase is Constitution 2, Strength 1.
Are there any other races that you can think of? At least common ones where con is the main increase?
Goliaths.
You did mention Goliaths, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm not even sure about that one.
Not off the top of my head.
Yeah.
It does seem like
Goliaths are strength.
Oh, okay.
Apparently Ganassis.
That makes sense.
Oh, certain. Yeah.
It is a nice one, though, to have increased by your racial ability, because that's just...
Right.
I guess, you know, points you don't have to spend on Constitution that you are going to spend anyways. So to some extent, it's like kind of feels like a free one. If you're using point buy, right, which we do, then... it makes it so you can't get like your main stat over, you know, 15, which is where we generally cap it out. So that can kind of suck. But you can come in with tons of health, which is great in Will's campaigns, yeah, where you can, you know, die at the drop of a hat. Otherwise, they have dark vision, of course, though centaurs didn't. So that's nice. Not everything right, does. Yeah. They do get claws, which just let them use a... unarmed attack with slashing damage 1d4 plus their strength mod. They get proficiency in a skill, athletics, intimidation, perception, or survival. But then probably most interesting is their daunting roar. So this lets them use a bonus action to make an especially menacing roar. Because if they didn't put especially in there, we just have no idea. A target has to succeed on a wisdom saving throw or become frightened of you until the end of your next turn. DC of the save equals 8 plus proficiency plus constitution. Once you use this trait, you can't use it again until you finish a short or long rest. This is really nice. The fact that it's limited to only a 10-foot radius kind of sucks. It's not like you're going to frighten the entire battlefield, but just getting a entire turn where potentially all of your enemies in nearby are frightened of you, can't move closer, have disadvantage on attack rolls as long as they're within you, or within your radius, as well as ability checks. It's a really nice ability, and it only being a bonus action has a low cost to use.
Yeah, it's great and flavorful.
Overall, I like the flavor of these. They look cool, so I think it'd be kind of a cool race to play. Their abilities, just okay. Like, the Daunting Roar is nice, but it's not going to come up all that often. It's a once per short rest thing, and a lot of them... times, you know, it's just frightened for a round. It's not going to like drastically impact how you play the character, and nothing else will, really, because like, there's not much of a reason to use claws.
No,
you know, nothing else is like really gonna truly strongly impact it. It's just okay, I guess. I don't know, I'm not super excited about these.
That's fair. I would argue that Daunting Roar, I don't know if it's going to change an entire combat, but as a free ability is, I don't know, that can be nice, giving disadvantage on all of your enemy's attack rolls if they fail the DC for a round is... That's not bad. That's really good, actually.
Yeah.
But I like tabaxis
more. I think
you're
just biased 'cause you play a tabaxi with feline agility, which is just fundamentally a broken ability.
Is that broken?
They're just like, there are most of the like racial do thing things don't do anything, as you're pointing out. I mean, they're just like, eh. Feline agility is like, you can use it all the time if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
So next is then Minotaurs, because I think that's enough on the Leonins. Minotaurs, I think everybody knows what a Minotaur is, but if you don't, it's a person with a buffalo head, which is pretty cool. They still are only the size category of medium. They're actually, I mean, size-wise, not as huge as I'd expect them to be. Their average height is like max of 7 feet, but mostly around like 6 foot. I don't know. When I think of a Minotaur, I think like 8 to 9 feet tall. But mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously I'm wrong. That's okay. They have horns, which are actually a much better unarmed strike compared to the claws or whatever else you'll see. These are 1d6 plus your strength modifier. So it is actually a dice category higher, which is good. You get Goring Rush, which is immediately after you use the dash action on your turn and move at least 20 feet, you can make one melee attack with your horns as a bonus action. That can be really nice because a lot of times when you're using dash, you kind of feel like you're giving up. Well, you are giving up something else. This might work in your favor where you can at least do some damage and it's not just going to be 1d4. With a strength increase of 2 and constitution score increase of 1, this isn't a crazy odd stat combo or anything. Probably going to be good for your melee builds.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, yeah, fighter, barbarian, paladin.
Perfect. Yeah, really? Strength, yeah. Ranger if you want to.
Then they have Hammering Horn, so immediately after you hit a creature with a melee attack as the attack action, you can use your bonus attack to attempt to shove them. They need to make it succeed on a strength saving throw or be pushed 10 feet away from you. And that's just something you could always do, as long as their size category is not no more than one size larger than you and they're within 5 feet of you.
Yeah, so that's really good. I mean, that's some good battlefield control, and you can do a lot of setup there if you need to push creatures into range for your wizard to start throwing spells at them or whatever. Mm-hmm. I could see a lot of good uses of that.
Yeah, definitely. And the DC is 8 plus your proficiency plus your strength modifier, so it's going to mm-hmm. be high. Yep, and then you have proficiency in either intimidation or persuasion.
No, Minotaurs have always been one of the stronger martial choices.
Yeah, so this one I do like, or unlike the Leonin, I feel like these abilities are going to come up regularly.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to really feel like you're going to feel like a Minotaur.
Yeah, you'll at least feel special for it compared to the Leonin, right, where it's like, man, I wish I was just a Tabaxi, which I could even see potentially just a player who's like, well, I don't really like the Leonin race. Can I just play a Tabaxi instead and say that in this world it's a Leonin? DM's probably going to be fine with that. Something to consider.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right. Next one is Satyr. This one I like and hate it. So first of all, they just sound fun. We haven't been talking about lore here or anything, but they're just like quirky, fun-loving, magical creatures. And they just sound like they kind of gave an excuse to be a fun character to play. Your charisma increases by 2 and dex by 1, which is a really good combination for
an amazing combination.
Yeah. A lot of classes. Yeah, your size is medium, not small. Initially, I thought they'd be small, which has some limited stuff, but they're still medium. 35 speed. You're fey instead of humanoid, so you are immune to a lot of abilities. You have ram, so it's just another type of unarmed strike. 1d4 plus your strength mod for bludgeoning damage. And then the really the big one, though, is magical resistance. You have advantage on saving throws against spells and other magical effects.
And banned from my table.
Well, that's real cool.
I mean, seriously, like, what justification can you have there so a race has something that powerful? Especially when they have an ability score combo that's arguably one of the better ones in the game. I mean, 2 charisma and 1 to dex, that's great for the charisma casters, which, as we know, there are plenty of. But advantage on saving throws against spells and other magical effects. Not even just spells, but and magical effects. I don't know. That's crazy.
Oh, okay. I did miss the other magical effects. I was going to say a lot of monsters and stuff don't technically cast spells, but yeah, magical effects.
If it was just spells, I think there'd be an argument for it, though it's still really strong. Definitely in agreement, though. Really not that many monsters that specifically cast spells. but all magical effects, that is really broad.
That's what at least that's what you and Ty Purebloods had. And it was broken then, it's broken now.
I don't remember that ever coming up.
It came up all the time. Kevin actually called me out on it, remember?
Where he'd like ask like,
oh, when you were hiding it? Yeah.
Yeah. I was pretending to be a human. He's like, why do you have advantage on all saving throws against spells and magical effects? I'm like, oh, it's a warlock thing.
Did the errata that out? Or is it?
No, it's still there.
Okay.
Well, I will obviously say that I didn't understand the implications of it back then. I mean, you could take that out. You just take that out entirely and look at this class or this race and tell me that it's a bad race.
It's a bad race.
Without that ability?
Yeah. I mean, so its ability score improvement's nice, but really all of them are. So that's not anything all that crazy. Fey instead of humanoid has trade-offs. That's like what we talked about with the centaur. You're immune to some, but more impacted by other spells. Ram, you do 1d4 plus strength instead of a punch. Like, that's not really going to come up much. Mirthful leaps. Whenever you take a high jump, you can roll a d8 and add the number rolled to the feet covered. And then Reveler, you have proficiency in performance and persuasion.
Yeah, Mirthful Leaps.
It's like really, really the only strong, really, really strong thing in here that sets them apart is magic resistance.
It looks to me like a player's handbook race without that, so I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how that got past anything and was allowed in. It's too strong. I don't know why it's in UNT Purebloods either.
Well, in UNT Purebloods defense, they're not... Monstrous characters are super optional. You're not supposed to allow them in campaigns.
Here's this thing that we released. Please don't use it.
Yes.
See, I don't know. I would have flat out just ban satyrs from the table. Just something to work around. It's like it's the one big benefit they have. They have advantage against saving throws.
And it's powerful, and it's like obviously extremely tantalizing for anyone who's trying to over-optimize their character, but it's not game-crushingly different than other races.
Right. I mean, you'll still fail saving throws. And then in addition, just target them with other stuff.
You're just beating
attack rolls. They expels that do attack rolls or don't force a save. Or just swarm them with marshals, because these are characters that are not going to be high AC marshal stuff.
They can be, though. And there's nothing like that stops them from being able to be a high AC martial character.
Yeah, I mean, just their ability scores don't really line up with it. With plus two charisma.
Makes a really good paladin.
I mean, I guess you could... I don't know if I'd say really good, but it makes a paladin.
Yeah, no, not being allowed at my table, that's for sure. That's too much. And that's okay, we can disagree on that.
Yeah.
Last one here is Tritons. These are the sea creatures.
Which also exist in Volos.
Yes, yes.
Don't they? Yeah.
All of these except Leonin and Satyr are pre-existing.
Right. I think that Minotaur, they changed around, though. I think, but I'd have to double check. So this one, ability score increase is plus one to strength, constitution, and charisma. It's pretty nice. They have a swimming speed by default of 30 feet, can breathe air and water. They get a couple of spells. Can cast Fog Cloud. At third level, they can cast Gust of Wind. At fifth level, they can cast Wall of Water. Once they cast a spell with this trait, you can't cast that spell with it again until you finish a long rest. So, Fog Cloud, Gust of Wind, and Wall of Water once per long rest. Wall of Water is pretty good. I think that one would probably be used often. Fog Cloud is a better spell, but is kind of situational. Gust of Wind, I think, is just situational. Probably not my favorite. But overall, I wouldn't mind having this. Everything else, I mean, it has dark vision, okay. And Emissary of the Sea, you can speak with fish. But they can't speak with you. No comments on that, I see. And the very last thing is resistance to cold damage.
Yeah, so these ones, the biggest thing they have going for them is their ability score. Plus one to three different ones. Strength, con, and charisma. Mm-hmm. It's basically like begging to make them paladins.
Con, charisma, yeah, it's basically all there.
Because, you know, if you do a point by, that's the one where you put Strength, Crown, and Charisma all at 15, and then Dex, Intelligence, and Wisdom at 8, and then gets plus 1, so those three stats start at 16.
Pretty good.
That's kind of nice. Yeah, these ones do feel a little underwhelming, though.
If you're not... They're super overwhelming if you are in the ocean.
Right.
That's true. And there's a whole section of this book dedicated to sea adventures.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's underwhelming. I think that it's situational, and when you're in that situation, it's definitely going to be the, you know, the part of your campaign where the Triton is shining because they already have the swim speed, they can already breathe underwater, they have all these stuff to control water, and that's just, you know, a leg up or a fin up.
Very true. Ha. Now they have legs.
They have fins on their legs.
I guess.
And saying wall of water once per day is, I don't know, that's a good spell. So I could see taking advantage of that.
Yeah, I think wall of water is new in this.
As a spell? No.
Yeah, it's the only one they just laid it out.
Elemental. Oh, that's because it's only an elemental evil.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it's not new, but it's not in like anything else that's official, I think.
That's why it is. Okay. But yeah, that's the races, the main races of Theros. Obviously, I'm sure somebody wanted to grab these and use them in other realms or bring other races into this realms, you know. Just work it out with you, DM.
Of course. All right. Next then, to what we're all here for. Well, that's not entirely true, but at least what I'm most excited about, which is subclasses. Always love some new subclasses, because that means we get new stuff to talk about when we talk about multiclassing.
Yeah, so there's two in this book, a bard and a paladin subclass. The bard being College of Eloquence. College of Eloquence bards their masters to the art of oratory. Persuasion is regarded as the highest art form to them, as well as well-reasoned, well-spoken arguments. They use a blend of logic and theoretical wordplay, winning over skeptics and detractors with logical arguments and plucking at heartstrings to appeal to the emotions of audiences. So they're kind of like master debaters. They're the manipulators. Things like that. But instead of using... You're laughing at master debaters.
Yeah, I am. I'm glad you used it.
So, instead of using like enchantment magic to beguile and trick and bring people over to your side and your cause, their idea is more, they use their words, they use their arguments. There's not so much magic to it. That's kind of the main difference between them and like glamour bards and mm-hmm. stuff like that. The first level ability, Silver Tongue. Your master saying the right thing at the right time. When you make persuasion or deception checks, you cheat a roll of a 9 or lower as a 10. The d20 roll.
And just to clarify, that's a third level ability. The first leveled ability of the subclass, though. Yep, just making sure.
I mean, so that's awesome. That's rogues get that reliable talent. I think at level 11, they could pick whatever mm-hmm. they want. But I'm getting this at third level for something's...
Yeah, and this definitely brings up what we've always tried to hammer home, is that a persuasion check is not the equivalent of changing the fabric of the world through your words. It's convincing somebody to listen to you more favorably. It doesn't have to be huge stuff. You can't just go up to the king and say, hey, I want your seat. Oh, roll a persuasion check. Natural 20. Oh, you get a seat.
The barbarian's king now.
You know.
That's yeah. how it has to work.
Yeah, so I think this is one that, depending on the table and how they treat persuasion checks, can seem very, very powerful, but it's really not. I mean, it's just a skill that they're averagely good at. There's still DCs higher than 15 out there.
So I will counter this, because what you're saying is technically right, but there's like this idea that like we kind of gamify the worlds that we play in and create artificial barriers that are obviously they have no bearing in reality. Whereas in reality, being a persuasive person to this extent is almost a superpower. You know, you could be a politician or a lobbyist or a very, very wealthy man with this kind of power. And if you have a very kind of realistic type play style at your table, this is the kind of thing that can make a character really, really good at just avoiding combat, avoiding tons of shit. Especially because it's not a 15. Very soon it's going to be probably expertise up to like bare minimum of 20.
Yeah,
which is
17. I was just figuring that out. So you can get expertise at third level. So when you get this ability, so picking a persuasion and deception, which doubles your proficiency bonus, which that level's plus 2, so you now have plus 4 to the roll, and then add your charisma to it, which we'll just say it's plus 3, because you're only at third level, you haven't hit your ability score, so that's plus 7 to the rolls, which are now a minimum of 10. It's like you literally cannot roll lower than a 17.
I like that a lot, and mm-hmm. it's obviously less versatile than reliable talent, but if you wanted to play a persuasive character, this is probably the best non-magical skill you can get.
Yeah, so really awesome, really hammers home the character you want to try and play without being game-breaking, because like you said, you can't just tell the king to kill themselves to end
right.
the tier.
But yeah, I think it is just going to encourage the player to continue trying to make those persuasive arguments, because there's, that's not that they're not going to fail, it's a, just, this is what you do. Keep trying to persuade people at every opportunity. Now, I have played with DMs, though, that I would not want to play this character. The type where, you know, you're, the classic example I always see is like in Fallout, those types of games. Every time somebody presents you a quest, they're like, hey, you know, I'll give you 500 caps if you do this for me. And there's always that option of, how about 600? You know, and just like the small types of like, hey, let me, you know, see if I can get a little more. Or just basically saying, like, can I get a bit more out of this than what you're willing to give me? I've played with DMs who are just like, no, nope, I don't. There's no role, nothing. This is what I'm offering and screw you. That's a time where as a DM, it's like, yeah, give it to them. And even if that means like starting off, you know, they're going to and you expect them to. So you start off every single quest with, hey, I'm going to give you 400 gold because you know they're going to counter with 500. Great. Sometimes they succeed and now they've got 500 gold instead of 400. Who cares? You know, and like just encourage that type of gameplay, because that then they're going to feel like, oh, yeah, I got more money out of this, when you're like, yeah, I balance around it. But, you know, let it happen. Let it be fun. And I guess let them fail every once in a while, as long as they're not asking for ridiculous things.
Yeah, the other third level ability, Unsettling Words. This is their unique use of Bardic Inspiration. All Bard subclasses get that. And I love this one. So you can expend a use of your Bardic Inspiration as a bonus action and choose one creature you can see within 60 feet, roll Inspiration die. Then the next time the creature makes a saving throw before the start of your next turn, they subtract your number rolled from their saving throw results.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic, especially because it's just a bonus action and it's not a spell, so you can set yourself up with this, because, you know, bards have a lot of spells that target saving throws.
Yeah, that's a good point. So you can set yourself up for this, not even somebody else.
Right.
I, at first, when I saw this, thought, like, well, isn't that just what Lore Bard does? But Lore Bard, you can't affect saving throws.
Correct, yeah. There's not many reliable ways to impact saving throws. Which makes sense, because, I mean, it's pretty powerful stuff. But it's nice, like, here
this
is an option.
It's hugely powerful, especially for your big nukes, so to speak. This could make something like Contagion profoundly dangerous, I think.
Man, he's still,
I mean, you can make him have this minus three times.
Waiting for it to activate, but still, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
It would cost you a lot, so, I mean, that's fair. It would cost you three rounds of time, it would cost you three bonus actions, and, of course, three uses of your Bardic Inspiration. But, yeah, I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, or using it, setting up for hold, hypnotic pattern, stuff like that, disintegrate later.
Literally
on.
Every spell. I mean, we could just sit here and list every single spell. It's, yes, it is good for that, because you want them to fail. That's spells.
The only thing you have to worry about, though, is uncooperative clerics.
What
give
do you
them
mean?
Disadvantage, or make this a subtract, and then they just immediately blow it with a, you know, sacred flame.
Oh, okay. Like, if you're like trying to set something up for the wizard, and your cleric's just like looks up from their phone, and they're like, "Oh, I cast sacred flame." It's like, ah. Yeah, I guess it does require some teamwork, because it is the next saving throw. It's not the next saving throw that you choose. So any of those little things, the initiative order, if you're not doing it for your own spells, then you have to be aware of the initiative order. You have to be aware of, everybody has to be aware that this thing is up and needs to be held for the important spell that's coming.
Right. Yeah, so right away, three levels of College of Eloquence is a really strong choice for multi-classing, or just, you know, going that way as a bard. I almost worry it gets too far. Like, both of those abilities by themselves, yeah, if you got one or the other, would probably be okay. But the fact you get two of them.
Yeah,
like, those are both pretty strong, both in combat and out of combat.
Yeah, the only limiting factor here is that what I notice with a small dip into Bard, like if you stay at only three levels, then you're not going to have your Bardic Inspiration come back on a short rest. It's probably going to take you a while to get your charisma to 5. So your focus, you're going to have like 3 uses of this per long rest for that bardic inspiration until you level it up more.
Which, it might be enough, though. It's because this is when you really need those saves to fail, for the enemy to fail those saves. It's usually not more than a few times per adventure.
It'll also only be a D6, though. When as you level up as Bard, you're going to want that to be the D8, D10, D12. I'm not disagreeing. I think that it is good. I don't think that it's as overpowered in actual play than it feels. Because then you're not using your Bardic Inspiration to inspire your teammates, because you need to save it for that saving throw. And if that's how you're using it, and just 3 times per day, you knock off up to, on average, we're talking 3.5 from saves, it might not actually be that strong.
It is in comparison. Like, as if we're just comparing third level dips, this is competitive for the best by far
for casters.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that, because I feel like College of Whispers with a martial class of 2d6 extra damage.
Right. Well, that's why I was saying casters.
Sorry. Okay. That's fair. I mean, cutting words is still really good, though.
This is probably going to enter the rotation of things we advise people to take in our multi-class segments with Bard.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. Yeah. No, I think I'm with you. It is good. It is good. I'm not arguing that at all. And I think it's interesting, too. It feels like a Bard.
For sure. Yeah, at first I was thinking this sounded like kind of just overlapping of a bunch of other Bard stuff, and then realized any other Bard subclass and flavor where it's dealing with persuading people, it's magical persuasion and tricking, where this is just speaking. You're just a really well-spoken person. It's like, it's almost boring, but I really like it still.
I love it. I feel like it is the silver tongue class that has not really existed in any kind of concrete way. So this is one, right. I mean, because we haven't gotten further yet, but let's keep going. With their 6-level ability being universal speech, you've gained the ability to make your speech.
You skipped one.
Oh, hey, I did.
Well, I guess they're both at 6th. So I was just a jerk there for interrupting you. We could have done them in any order. Do them as presented in the book, Jared.
Yep. This is really good. Your inspiring words are so persuasive that others feel driven to succeed. When a creature adds one of your bardic inspiration dice to its ability checks, attack roll, or saving throw, and the roll fails, the creature can keep the bardic inspiration die. This is why I love this class. I don't even care about the saving throw thing. Yeah, that's nice, but like, this is my favorite thing ever, because so many times you give bardic inspiration and it fails, and you're like, well, why did I even bother? But people aren't going to be worried about using it at the soonest opportunity, because, you know, there is no failure points for it.
Yeah. I mean, it still has its limits. I think 10 minutes it runs out. And if it's used successfully, you still lose it. So you don't just keep it indefinitely. But it is definitely very nice. I do kind of always like it when there's an ability or something where it takes away that somewhat risk of things. Like, which, like, spellcasting in general, you always hear there's an argument. For spells that just happen, there's no chance of failure. That's always a perk for it. And in a sense, it's kind of... That's sort of in that same philosophy.
It's going to go until it's actually worthwhile.
Right. All right. Now you can talk about universal speech.
Oh, can I? Are you sure there's no miscellaneous flavor text in between that I have to bring up first?
There's not. Nope. Or, you know, alphabetically. There.
All right. Universal speech. You've gained the ability to make your speech intelligible to any creature. As an action, choose one or more creatures within 60 feet of you, up to the number equal to your charisma modifier. Chosen creatures can magically understand you, regardless of the language you speak, for 1 hour. You can use this feature once per long rest, or expend a spell slot to use it again. It doesn't say which spell slot, so I assume even first level will let you do this again, which is totally fine with. This is not that important that I would want somebody to have like already used it today and not have a way to get it again.
Right. No, I think this is another solid one. A good out of combat utility. It's language barriers seem to come up a lot, at least in our campaigns and adventures, and also especially in pre-written ones, we see that stuff a lot. It's the way around it. Yeah, I'm kind of surprised they get both of these things at sixth level, because they're both solid. It's not like one's just like a ribbon ability or something.
Do bards normally get six level ribbon abilities?
No, like, but getting two right. strong things. You know, Valor and Swords get their extra attack at sixth.
Yeah, which I think is comparable just to the unfailing inspiration to some extent.
Right.
So exactly, it does seem like they're kind of getting something for free.
Yeah. But then again, I don't know. Sixth is, I guess, strong because of the extra attack. Lore bards get their additional magic secrets where they can pick two spells from any list in the game, which is nice. Valor gets their mantle whispers where they kill someone, they can assume their
whispers,
identity.
Whispers gets that. You said Valor. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Whispers. So, okay. Maybe sixth is actually a really strong level for bards.
Yeah, it generally is.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Glamour gets Mantle of Majesty where they could cast Command without expending a spell slot for a minute. Just like every turn.
I don't think bards have a bad level,
okay.
though.
No, it's, bards are awesome. That's why I always say they're my favorite class. They're my warlock.
They're so garbage. Fight me. But this is actually a good... I was thinking the exact same thing. This is a good combination that makes up for the core class feature nature of 6th level, whereas this is just two very solid things.
Right.
All right, so then 14th level is Infectious Inspiration. So this is when you successfully inspire someone, the power of your eloquence can now spread to someone else. When a creature within 60 feet of you adds one of your bardic inspiration dice to its ability checks, attack rolls, or saving throws, and the roll succeeds, you can use your reaction to encourage a different creature that can hear you, giving it bardic inspiration without expending any of your bardic inspiration uses. You can use this reaction equal to a number of times, equal to your charisma modifier and regain them all on a long rest. So you're basically getting an extra 5 uses of bardic inspiration as long as you're inspiring your allies.
Right. No, another solid one. Though, kind of what you mentioned earlier, I do wonder if people are going to feel the need to save their bardic inspirations for the unsettling words to lower the saves and not use it as an actual bardic inspiration die.
I think in a multi-class, yes. I think if you were getting up to 14th level in this, though, you are going to use your Bardic Inspiration to help people mainly, but you still have plenty of uses for when you need them to fail that saving throw.
That's very true. You would still get 5 per short rest at this point. Because, I mean, there's no way your charisma wouldn't be 20.
I don't know
20.
If I want to get it there yet. You know, maybe I just want to get my dex up.
this class really makes you powerful at using those particulars. Benefits. This is probably the class where using this to benefit your party works the best.
Yes. Yeah, it's how I felt, how I've always felt with the lore bard, where the lore bard to me is like the most bardy bard. This one takes place, in my opinion. I think this earns the title of the most bardy bard, in the same way that Battlemaster is the most fightery fighter.
It's champion!
Wow. It's,
get out of here!
Nope.
Yeah.
It's Battlemaster.
In terms of mechanical viability, I think this is a contender of Lombard. That's for sure.
Let's get out of here with your crits on a 19.
Goes down to 18, bro.
Yeah, and so, I mean, flavor-wise, I think it's amazing. Mechanics, I think it's amazing.
Get the fuck out of here. Like, played so many
long-running bards already. So it's been a while since I've just been like a support caster.
Oh my god. This is it. This is when your character is going to dip into bard, isn't it?
I have the charisma. Paladin rogue bard.
No! Don't do it.
No, we're not going to do that. No, I'm still stuck on that Artificer Cleric. That's probably still going to be the next character. Or just straight Artificer, just to try that out. Anyways, multiclassing. I think an Inquisitive Rogue with the College of Eloquence could be really cool. The Inquisitive Rogue is the one, they're like Sherlock Holmes, they're investigators, they get huge boost to perception and insight and insightful fighting and things like that. Mashing that up with College of Eloquence just seems like it would be a really cool combination of like the really intelligent, perceptive, insightful person who then uses that to be able to manipulate and persuade people and argue for their points.
The one we were talking about, we did the other week, the Cavalier, bard. So if it was cavalier elegance, I could see that very much so being like a noble who is literally a politician. You are the politician character, who's also an adventurer.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly, the only thing that I find difficult with this class is the fact of why are you an adventurer when you really should just be a politician or something?
Okay, you still have all the other bard stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, you can use that stuff all out of combat. Just give yourself bardic inspiration left and right.
I don't think you could do that.
Give yourself bardic inspiration?
I don't think you... Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can. Right.
That's a great idea for a new college. The College of Narcissism.
Inspiring yourself.
You can only use your bard features on yourself, but they're souped up. Like, crazy souped up.
I was going to say the College of Self-Confidence, but I like narcissism.
Now, this is the Oathbreaker version of a bard.
Ooh, tired of helping your friends.
Yeah, all your spells time are going to be offensive yourself. Or self-cast. It's going to be great.
So I guess expect us to talk a lot more about the College of Eloquence, because that's just going to keep coming up. On to the Oath of Glory Paladin. Expect us to not talk about this one a lot. I don't love this one. The whole point is that it is somebody who is just destined to achieve glory through deeds of heroism. Very fitting for this book, as we've already discussed. They train diligently and encourage their companions to so that they're all ready when destiny calls. I don't know where we want to start with this. I never do.
I mean, in terms of that kind of flavor and stuff, I think that's fine. They are so strongly devoted to the idea that their actions matter more than anything else, and that they have to achieve greatness in the world, that they are able to draw power from the universe.
Yep, I like that.
Like, okay, that's cool. I mean, that's kind of what they are. Their tenets of glory are actions over words. Challenges are but tests. Hone the body and discipline the soul.
Very.
All fitting. Nothing wrong there. Yep.
Their oath spells, they're okay. I'm never huge on the oath spells just because it's hard to justify casting spells over smiting a lot of the times as a paladin. Like, Guiding Bolt is a very big, like, if you miss, it is pointless. But it is a really good spell, Guiding Bolt. The only issue is that it relies on your charisma modifier, and as a paladin, that's probably not going to be what you get to 21st. They struggle a lot with that. When I played a paladin, I struggled with that a lot, of going up in strength or going up in charisma, because they're both very important to the character. So yeah, getting that up higher, who knows, maybe you will. Heroism is a great spell, or at least a...
That's the opposite of Bless.
No,
oh, no,
you're thinking of Bane.
Gain temporary hit points, yeah. Gain temporary hit points equal to your spellcasting ability modifier.
For first level, it's not bad.
Oh, it's one creature at the start of each of its turns. Gain temporary hit points equal to your spellcasting ability modifier.
So if you have that high charisma, it's pretty good. But I mean, we're talking about the difference between 5 HP and 3 HP, basically, per turn. It's not amazing. Immune to frightened can be helpful. But the fact that it's concentration, I'm probably never going to cast this.
Mm-hmm. And like... Yeah, especially because paladins are going to be getting hit. They're not hanging out in the back to protect their concentration. And then again, you're choosing that over smite.
Fifth level, they get enhance ability and magic weapon. Enhance ability, I'm not a huge fan of in general. It basically gives you advantage on specific checks. I don't know. This one is a long spell to read off, so I'm not sure if I want to. But the overall concept is you get advantage on some specific checks. It's good if you know that a type of check is going to come up, and it's going to come up over and over. Comparing it to guidance, though, just for like a single time use of like, oh, I need to jump over this chasm. It's like, all right, you know, here's a guidance for your upcoming athletics check. I'm not going to waste a second level spell just to get you that.
Right. I mean, it's concentration for an hour, and there's also stuff like Bear's Endurance, where the advantage on con checks also gives you 2d6 temporary hit points and things like that.
That's
Yeah. Again, just choosing that over other paladin.
Or you can deal 3d8 smite damage. Stuff. The way God intended. Or your God intended. Magic weapon, nothing too special, +1 to a weapon. Once again, concentration. So that hurts a lot.
Yeah. But it's nice in a pinch when if you're get thrown. Like, if it would be kind of crappy at fifth level, but if you're going after enemy that's immune to non-magical attacks, it's like, all right, well, I got this.
To totally agree. Totally agree.
But
ninth level gets haste. Love haste. Casting it on yourself as a paladin, though.
Yeah. Haste is, it's better for the wizard to cast it on you than the paladin to cast it on themselves. Because again, it's concentration. They're up in the fray, right, going
to
get hit.
And as we already said, it's difficult to choose between strength and charisma. And now you're saying, oh, I need my constitution to be 20 as well so I can maintain concentration on haste better. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Other ones of note, higher levels, they get commune, which is kind of cool. I don't know if it's very fitting because I don't associate this specific subclass with gods by any means. It seems very much so dedicated, right, to destiny more than it is being religious. So it's a good spell. I don't love it being given to this class, though.
Yeah, it feels a little
And then Flame Strike, which I think is the coolest spell ever. So at least has that going for
it. It's just not very good.
No, it's not amazing, but I love the idea of just making columns of fire, a single one, a single column of fire.
Mm-hmm. So at third level, they get their channel divinity options. This is where they, once per short or long rest, use one of these abilities and it uses it up. All paladins get a different option at third level, different subclasses. They have two to pick from. Peerless Athlete and Inspiring Smite. If you choose Peerless Athlete as a bonus action, you can use your Channel Divinity to augment your athleticism. For 10 minutes, you have advantage on athletics and acrobatics checks, and you can carry, push, drag, and lift twice as much weight as normal, and your long jump and high jump increases by 10 feet. I guess if you're trying to grapple, that's the biggest thing. Like, I mean, there is probably some out of combat times where this could be useful, where you know you need to make a tough jump. It's like, all right, let me use this. Or you need to carry something really heavy, those exciting D&D moments like that. And it's like, all right, I got this, guys. But I mean, the advantage on athletics and acrobatics, if we're talking in
combat.
I mean,
maybe it's something that, you know, grappling, since you know it's here, the DM kind of sets up some cool instances. The first thing that I think of is, did either of you play Resident Evil 5?
Yes.
Okay. At the end of Resident Evil 5, Chris Redfield has a moment where he's fighting the big bad guy Wesker in a volcano, and he has to cross a chasm, and he has a large boulder that's blocking him, and he punches the boulder into the lava so that he can go across. It's the dumbest thing in the world, but I think very fitting.
The boulder
for this
is taller than him.
Yeah.
It's like a solid 6.5 foot muscle bound dude. The boulder is the size of a small car.
And he just starts right hooking into it.
And for the record, Chris Redfield has no superpowers.
No. Just a normal guy. So that's
just a peerless athlete in a way.
Right. So I think that that is where it's like kind of a fitting instance is like in the D&D world, that's all fine. Like, oh, there's a boulder in your way and you're like, I need to get to my friends, channel divinity and start punching a boulder. So that's sure. Up to the DM to create those scenarios where it would feel worthwhile and more important, flavorful to use that. If you want your character to be Chris Redfield punching a boulder.
Or if you participate in track and field competitions.
Yeah.
Or again, you want to make a grappler. Usually grappler builds are based around something that's more reliable than like a once per short rest ability. But, you know, giving yourself advantage on athletics and acrobatics checks makes it hard for enemies to break out of your grapple or for you to be, makes it easier for you to be able to break out of grapples.
And above all, not above all, that's the wrong way to put that. In addition, it is only a bonus action to start this. A lot of channel divinities, they are really good, but they're a whole action, which was like what I struggled with when I played a paladin, was like, oh my god, I have to have an entire turn of setup just to get to what I want to do.
Right.
This doesn't have that.
Yeah. The other option is Inspiring Smite. Immediately after you deal damage using Divine Smite, you can use this channel divinity as a bonus action and distribute temporary hit points to creatures of your choice within 30 feet. This can include you. The number of temp hit points is 2d8 plus your level in this class. Divide as you see fit. Like, it's okay. I guess this is another case where just temp hit points just seem low.
Yeah.
But I guess if you do that and then give them all to yourself or all to one person, it could kind of be a lot.
Yeah, I don't particularly love this, especially with how many things can give or have temp HP right now. Maybe that's not really the point, but you know, you do always have to remember that temp HP doesn't stack by any means. It replaces. At lower levels, though, this is going to... This has the opportunity to feel like nothing. Because if you're just level 5 and you roll 2 ones, then this sucks. You know, you're like, oh, I gave 7 HP to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It has the opportunity at max to give 36 HP at level 20. And that's just not good.
Yeah. I mean...
It's okay.
Nobody has, great stuff in the... that's not true. There's a lot of these classes that just don't have great channel divinities, and they're kind of just, mm-hmm. eh. This is a pretty good, eh.
Fair.
Like, just free temp what, HP.
Okay, that's fair. And what I will say is that I would expect this to be used every short rest, unlike a lot of other ones.
It's not hard to use.
No, that's very true. But then it compares to, the Vengeance Paladin's option, Vow of Enmity. It's also a bonus action, and you choose a creature, and you have advantage on all attacks for a minute against them. There's no concentration. There's nothing that ends it early unless you
die. Yeah, I don't really get how that one slipped through. I'm just, in comparison to the other Bard ones, looking at Oath of Devotion, which was one of the Player's Handbook ones. Yeah.
Paladin ones, but yeah.
You can use an action... and you make your weapon a +1 weapon. Oh, no, I'm sorry. You add your charisma modifier to attack rolls made with your weapon. So that's at most +5. Now, it also makes the weapon magical, so I guess that's something.
Which is the equivalent to advantage.
An action to do. An action compared to Vow of Enmity, which is a bonus action. I mean, that's the main thing. If Sacred Weapon was the exact same but a bonus action, I think it would be... on par with Vengeance, or if Vengeance was an action, I think it'd be on par with everything else, but it just seems a little strong in comparison.
Keep in mind also, Vow of Enmity is you target a creature, correct, and you have advantage on that creature. With the Devotion one, it's your mm-hmm. weapon, and so you could have the benefit on all attacks.
Yeah, but giving up
creatures.
An entire attack to do it, not even just one, I mean, potentially 2 attacks, you know, at level 5.
Part of the issue is the Vow of Enmity. It seems like something that would balance out okay, but it doesn't, because it just, every time you need that situation, it's one fucking dude. It doesn't matter that you can't do it to the rest of everybody. When it really comes push to shove, that's the, it's just really, really solid in most sessions.
Mm-hmm. And then there could be arguments made where if you go through the rest of the subclass, that Devotion will get other things that are stronger than the Vengeance Paladins and stuff like that. And we don't need to dissect into that right now, but you do need to look at more than just skill to skill to comparison. You need to look at the classes as a whole.
Now you're making me want to, though. Because what's the aura that Vengeance get? They don't even get an aura.
I don't even know.
Weird. Right? Yeah, they get at 7th level, your supernatural focus helps you close off a foe's retreat. When you hit a creature with an opportunity attack, you can move up to half your speed immediately after the attack, and as part of the same reaction, that movement doesn't provoke opportunity attacks. So when you hit, it makes your opportunity attacks better. Usually paladins get an aura of some sort that is specific to their oath around that point. Devotion is you just can't be charmed.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I say we can argue about the comparison at some point. I think Vengeance is definitely a little bit stronger than most of the other Paladin subclasses, which isn't like an attack at you because you're playing a Vengeance Paladin right now.
Right.
I just think it is just universally better than any of the other options.
Yeah, definitely in combat at least. I mean, all of the stuff is combat focused.
All right, so back to Oath of Glory. At 7th level, they get their aura. You emanate an aura that fills you and your companions with supernatural speed, allowing you to race across a battlefield in formation. Your walking speed increases by 10. In addition, if you aren't incapacitated, the walking speed of any ally who starts their turn within 5 feet of you increases by 10 feet until the end of that turn. That aura, of course, increases in range at 18th level by 10 feet. So, make everybody faster.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a really short range. They have to be within 5 feet of you.
That's where it gets tough. I mean, it's good at the start of combat. It's going to give everybody the extra 10 feet they need to get into formation. After that, probably not going to come up that much. But it's still okay. I mean, I see it being used at the very least, because then you go up front line and you've got a fighter as well. The fighter kills the last enemy around you guys and then wants to use their movement. Well, hey, you've got an extra 10 feet to go run over to where you need to get to.
Right. And then the paladin itself will always have 10 feet extra movement. It's just its speed's permanently increased.
Super good.
Which is nice, yeah.
I don't think it's the strongest aura by any means, but it's not the weakest. It's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. All right, then 15th Glorious Defense. You could turn defense under sudden strike. When you or another creature within 10 feet of you is hit by an attack roll, you can use your reaction to grant a boost to the target's AC, potentially causing it to miss. The bonus is your charisma modifier. If it misses, you can make one weapon attack against the creature as part of their reaction, provided you're within weapons range. You could use this up to your charisma modifier and regain all uses on a long rest. So it's pretty much, at best, 5 times per long rest. But, I mean, it is a nice ability.
It is. I think my only issue with it is the fact that it's gatekeeped at 15th level.
Yeah.
It seems a little underwhelming for 15th level. It's another opportunity to smite, though.
It's like a free shield,
yeah,
pretty much, that you could use for on allies as well.
Yeah, I like the fact that you can use it on yourself, but yes, as well as on allies. I feel like you're going to use it on yourself more often just because then you are most likely already within range. Compared to if it's an ally, there's a chance they're 10 feet away, and then you don't get the extra attack. I mean, that's just some weirdness to it.
Yeah. Well, you need to be within range of the attacker. So you could be, they could be between you two or something.
Right, but then you wouldn't be able, if they were, it doesn't matter. Point is, there are opportunities to use it, yes. But at 15th level, it just seems a little bit underwhelming.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think like this entire class or this subclass is just kind of universally underwhelming to me.
Maybe
it's just like it's okay. It's definitely not terrible. That'll get used a lot.
Yep. You'll probably use all five every single time.
Right. And then I mean if you compare it to shield, are by 15th level are the casters using shield more than 5 times in an adventuring day?
No idea.
I don't know. I think probably not.
Jeez, I don't know.
And then you have the option to hit again, which, as you said, is another opportunity to smite.
Yeah.
And another opportunity to crit and then smite. you know, they could... I kind of like this one. I think it's fine.
Okay. I don't know what to say. Counterpoint, that's not the right way to put this, but just things to think about. Shield lasts for your entire turn or until the start of your next turn. This is just for one attack.
Yeah.
Shield's also a spell slot, but that's just obvious. But also, right. Paladins, we expect to be, once again, up in the fray. They're going to get hit more, whereas, no, maybe casters aren't using 5 shields per day, but they're also hopefully not getting even hit that many times. But when they get hit, they're probably casting shield.
Right. Very true.
Last one is Living Legend. You can empower yourself with the legends, whether true or exaggerated, of your great deeds. As a bonus action, you gain the following benefits for 1 minute. You are blessed with an otherworldly presence, gaining advantage on all charisma checks. Not saving throws, just checks. Once on each of your turns, when you make a weapon attack and miss, you can cause that attack to hit instead. Okay, that's cool. And then if you fail a saving throw, you can use your reaction to re-roll it. You must use this new roll. That's at least all pretty good stuff. I don't know about how I feel about the advantage on charisma checks. Obviously, that's like an out of combat thing, but just at 20th level, I don't know if advantage on... At that point, if you can't get your way and you're level 20, I don't know what there is to do. Like, who is going to turn down the level 20 adventurers?
Well, I mean, within the land of Theros, there's a lot of mythical creatures.
There's
that
probably like hundreds of level
20 Yeah.
It's like Ironforge in there. It's like, oh, you're level 60. Congrats,
right.
Buddy.
Okay, that's fair.
No, I think this is actually a really solid paladin capstone. Sure, the charisma checks, it's kind of a ribbon thing thrown in.
Right.
Just because you have this presence. The other two make up for
yeah. Very good.
For it. Yeah, if you miss with a weapon attack, you could have it hit instead. But fail saving throw, use your action to reroll it. And you could just do this for every round for a minute.
Yeah. I mean, this is the type of stuff that in the like more intense fights, you are using this right away, and you are going to be very happy about it. Because some of these things, when they've got an AC of 26, you're going to be missing. You know, it's like,
right.
It's hard to hit them. That's all there is to it. But just letting you actually hit, letting you continue bringing that damage down, and getting the saving throw thing is just really... Yeah, no, I'm on board. I'm with you. This is a really good capstone.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of competition, I'll say that much. And it's still, it still just kind of comes to me as,
you're hard to please.
Is that anything new? We've been doing this for 2 years almost, Kevin. You really gonna...
Not a warlock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, did you...
A lot of competition with the with warlocks.
did you mention that? So you get this for free once per long rest, or after using, you can use a fifth level spell slot to use it again.
Yeah, that's really good too.
Yeah, and I would say this is something that very much outcompetes Smite.
Oh yeah, yeah.
This will probably be a lot more beneficial than just smiting at fifth.
Is this the only? This is the only one that can do that, right?
Yeah,
use it again. I think.
Uh huh.
I know. Vengeance gets to like wings and fly around, Avenging Angel, which is also really cool. But yeah, it's just a once per long rest.
Everybody gets this crazy minute long craziness, but yeah, I think this is the only one that does the fifth level thing. So that that kind of actually makes it better, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. So overall, I guess I have mixed feelings on this one. This subclass gets better the longer you stay in it, which is a little unfortunate because a lot of just campaigns and adventures don't get that high. Like third level, it's Channel Divinities. They're like just okay. And then at seventh, its aura is, a little better in speed and all that. And then 15th starting to get pretty good, and Living Legend is great, but how often do you play at 20?
Yeah, and maybe this is kind of a fitting for the setting then, in the sense that you might anticipate playing higher level campaigns in a Theros setting because everybody's a badass. You know, you wake up and you and 20 other people were bathed in Hydra blood. That's what they don't tell you about that background. When you're like, oh, I was bathed in Hydra blood. There was like, that was just bathe children in Hydra blood day.
That was like your entire Dekar class.
Right.
the Hydra came in and all right, here's my blood. It was a really good, nice cooperative Hydra.
Right. Well, what does it care? You just pay it, you cut off a head, it grows back two more. That seems pretty useful.
Right, yeah.
Why is the Hydra so grumpy? That is a question for a different day.
It's a metaphysical question in the D&D world we do not want to go down.
No.
Why is everything so grumpy all the time?
Because they have so many teeth in
their yeah, so now I'm with you, though. I think that early levels... not that excited about this. So because of that, it's not going to be one that'll be perfect for multiclassing in. As a solo class, I feel it's going to be a lot of sitting there and just going, this will one day pay off. This will one day pay off. And it might not.
Or you just start at a higher level. You know, if you start at level 12, like a level 12 campaign starting there, sure. Three levels away to Glorious Defense, and then you get all... It's not like the rest of Paladin is bad.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So.
No.
Okay, so that's everything around everything.
Character options.
Yeah, around character options. Do we want to move on to our monster of the week, the Tromocratus? Before we get into our monster of the week, I just want to say make sure to subscribe to us wherever you can, get your podcasts, and make sure to leave a review as well. Those 5 stars really help other people find us, and that makes us happy. Otherwise, follow us on social media. We've got Twitter, @monsters_multi, as well as a subreddit, which is Monsters and Multiclass, where you can discuss episodes, post funny things related to the episodes, or find other people who like it. Also, send us questions. We generally, not this episode, but generally do a question segment on the episodes. And those are usually gathered from social media purposes. So if you've got anything you want us to talk about, anything that we missed in the episodes, whatever, talk with us and we're happy to discuss it. Because that's what we do. We talk about D&D.
All right. So there was a full B Street in here for Theros Masters and all that. We haven't looked at it in great detail, but there is one section we want to highlight, the Mythic Monsters. So this is a new concept I haven't seen officially in 5th edition yet, where these are supposed to be mythical level encounters where they all have a mythic trait. They usually involves, once you kill it, it just changes forms. This is a concept you hear about a lot, that where a lot of people suggest you build your bosses around this, and just here it is in kind of an official format. There's three mythic monsters in here. We're going to highlight one of them, but they're all really worth checking out. The one we're looking at, as stated, is the Tromokratos. It's a mythic kraken, basically. It's a terror of the ocean, but specifically, which makes it even more terrifying, they don't hang out in the deep ocean and attack ships. The Tromokratos' whole MO is to come in, ravage coastal cities. So it's actually a really big, scary issue. In Theros, challenge rating 26 as the mythic conditions, which we'll get to at the end, which basically means you have to fight it twice. And it's even harder the second time. Should be a hell of a fight. What do you guys think?
Absolutely in love with the mythic concept. I am really hoping that they release more along these lines. I know that it's something that I have definitely experimented with before, as you had mentioned, Kevin, just the concept of a boss fight that basically has two health pools and two stages. I think it is nothing new at all for the concept of like video games and games in general, but D&D has never really put it into mechanics, and here we are.
Yeah, these in particular have really put the... something like the Tarrasque in perspective. These are very, very, very difficult encounters. Sadly, we very rarely fight these, and I think they'd be pretty exhausting, but I like the concept a lot.
Yeah, one of my questions of this is like, how long are these fights going to take? I mean, we've had some combats that are, you know, range in the 2 hours when they're like the really intense end of campaign combats. The fact that it could take 2 hours to get to that point, and then you have round two of everything. Oh boy, these could be long.
Yeah, these are session long combats. If you're an hour into a session and you get to the point where it's okay, we are now fighting this thing, end the session and start it next time.
Ooh, or like, I mean, I could see the mythic part of it where you like drop the HP the first time, the DM describes it coming back, and then you're like, we'll pick up next week. Like that's a good cliffhanger is when it's coming back.
Yeah.
Provides a natural stopping point to combat almost.
Right. Alright, so to get into specifics on the Tromokratos, which like I said is basically just like a big old kraken. Like krakens are already legendary encounters.
Yeah, so it's just like the idea of a big old kraken, because it's like that's krakens, big and old. So more of that.
Yeah, so it's a gargantuan monstrosity counted as a titan. The picture of this thing is really cool. It's sticking out of the ocean and it's towering over a city, which is also completely wrecking. It has 22 AC, 409 hit points, strength of 30, con of 29. The rest of the stats are kind of unimpressive. Dex.
22 int.
Oh, I missed that. I didn't realize it was so intelligent. That doesn't really come up in the stat block at all.
No.
Or in its lore.
It can't speak, so.
Yeah, it can't speak. There's not lore about it manipulating people or amassing followers. Huh.
But you're not going to trick it.
No, yeah. Yeah, 22 ints, dex, wisdom, charisma, 11 and 10, respectively. Saving throws, intelligence plus 14, wisdom plus 8. Resistance to cold, lightning, and thunder, and immune to fire, bludgeoning, piercing, and slashing from non-magical attacks. At this point, it's challenge rating 26. If you're fighting this thing, you're going to have magical weapons, so it's just kind of a gate there. But immunity to fire is interesting. A lot of very high damage spells are fire. And by then, resistance to cold, lightning, and thunder, too. It's immune to being charmed, frightened, paralyzed, or restrained. It has blindsight out to 120 feet. Passive perception is 10, though, so I guess you can sneak up on it.
Yeah, I guess you get that. I don't think I'd want to sneak up on this thing. That seems like a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amphibious, can breathe air or water. Swim speed of 80 feet. I missed that. Its right non-swim speed is 30 feet, which actually seems kind of slow for its size, but I guess that's really meant for water.
Yeah.
I don't think it has legs, man.
And also to some extent, when a creature is gargantuan, I don't really think it has to worry too much about moving anywhere. It's right where it wants to be. It's up to your players to move around it.
Very true. It has 3-day legendary resistances where if it fails a save, it can choose to succeed it. Its weapons attacks are magical. It's a siege monster, so it's double damage to objects and structures. And it has advantage on saving throws against spells. And any creature that makes a spell attack against it has disadvantage on that attack roll. So, right away, hard to hit, high AC, crazy health, ridiculously high saves with legendary resistances and advantage on all spell saving throws. I mean, this thing is hard as hell to just hit.
It's a CR 26. It's not messing around.
Yes, it's a mythic CR 26. This is the peak of fighting. Its actions as multi-attack, 3 attacks, one with its pincer, one with its tail, one with its tentacle. Its pincer is 20 plus 18 hit, 20 foot reach, does 3d6 plus 10 bludgeoning damage, and the creature is grappled with an escape of DC 26.
Well, if you were a paladin and could give yourself...
I was going to say, you peerless athlete.
Yeah.
You're also restrained by this grapple, so it's not the crappy grapple, it's the good grapple.
The crapple.
It has its tail, again, plus 18 to hit, 24 reach, 3d, 8 plus 10, bludgeoning damage, and the target is knocked prone. And then tentacle grasp, 18 to hit, 24 reach, 3d6 plus 10, bludgeoning damage, grappled again. If it doesn't escape by the end of its turn, it throws the target up to 60 feet in a straight line, landing prone and taking 6d6 bludgeoning damage.
One thing I find interesting is it doesn't say it takes, 6d6 damage per 10 feet thrown. It's just straight up, it's going to throw you 60 feet in a straight line. If you hit something, you hit something, but you take the 6d6 regardless.
Right. I think the idea is it's so much force behind the throw.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those 3 attacks, does each one of those every single turn. Then it also has its bite, which is kind of typical bite for any gargantuan creature like this. 5-foot reach, 18 to hit, 3d12 plus 10 piercing damage, and if the target is grappled, it is now swallowed. At the start of each of its, the Tremocratus' turn, it takes 12d6 acid damage, which is very high. The creature inside needs to deal 50 damage on a single turn, which causes the Tremocratus to make a constitution saving throw of DC of 20, otherwise it regurgitates the swallowed creature. That's a pretty typical mechanic.
Right. Yeah, and the one thing that I found interesting is that the way that its multi-attack works, it does not get to use that bite for free. So if it wants to bite on a creature that is grappled, ignoring legendary actions, because I'll get to that in a second, but if it wants to swallow something, it needs to use its entire action to do that, which is actually kind of a lot. It's the one saving grace the players get, is that it is kind of difficult for it to, or it's costing a lot of its own resources to swallow a creature.
Right. And we've talked about the details of the swallow kind of mechanics in the past, and for some classes, you're just kind of screwed.
It's a death sentence. What? I said for some classes, it's a death sentence.
Yeah, and then this one's even worse. You have to do 50 damage in a turn. That's really high for some. And then it still gets the chance to make a constitution saving throw.
Which it has plus 9
to. Which it has plus 9 to. Yeah.
Yep. So
if it rolls an 11 or more, it's... Yeah. But I guess a 20, you have a lot of different spells and abilities and maybe stuff that can get you out of there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it still just depends on what you are, I guess.
Yeah.
Even something like a rogue, since they're going to be restrained in there and blinded, they'll have disadvantage on the attack, so they can't get sneak attack for any reason.
Right.
So that's how's a rogue going to get out of there? Dash? I mean, I know that literally doesn't work.
Right.
So they're screwed. Some spellcasters might be fine, but A fighter putting four hits into it, sure, I guess they'll probably easily do 50 damage. A paladin, sure. Barbarian, fine, but like bards? Nah.
No, yeah. Yeah, since you're blinded, you can't target it with a lot of spells. I guess the hope is having a spell that lets you teleport out of there. There's a lot of high-level spells that we're not super familiar with because we just don't get there.
Yeah, but I would also even argue that not letting it get to that point is probably priority number one, unless you're the barbarian who's just like a total madman who's just like, yeah, I'm restrained, who cares, get thrown inside,
reckless attack. Yeah. And yeah, it's just obviously it doesn't matter, reckless attack, there's nothing to give you to attack back, so
yeah, just
cancel out your disadvantage.
And if it's a barbarian, they've got resistance to all of the damage anyways, and just go to town, right. Who cares.
Yeah.
Legendary actions, though, these aren't anything too crazy, but the one that's most important that I'm actually just going to start with is the bite that cost it all of its legendary actions. So the bite itself can happen, again, as a normal action, but it takes up all of the other attacks that it could possibly do, whereas a bite as a legendary action feels a lot more reasonable to use. You're not able to move, you're not able to use that tail attack, but it's a good time to use it and a good use of those legendary actions.
Mm-hmm.
So its other ones are it can move up to half its speed, which if it's on land is 15 feet. That's super not impressive. And then its tail, it just makes one tail attack, so can knock somebody prone and do a lot of damage. I would expect the bite to be used most, if not every time on the for legendary action economy.
Right, yeah. Because otherwise it's just you're giving up three really solid attacks. So that is the core stat block of the Trimocratus.
Yeah, are you scared?
Which is already up.
if you're not quaking in your boots, you're not paying attention.
Hard as hell fight. It's challenge rating 26 just as is, even without the mythic stuff coming in. But then it has its mythic abilities, the Heart of the Kraken. So when the Trimocratus is reduced to zero hit points, it doesn't die or fall unconscious. Instead, the damage creates cracks in its carapace, revealing its hearts. It has four hearts, two on its chest and one on its back, and one on the base of its tail. A heart has an AC of 22 and 100 hit points. It is immune to bludgeoning, piercing, and slashing from non-magical attacks and is immune to all conditions. If it's forced to make a save, it has a ability score of 10. If the Trimocratus can finish short or long rest, the carapace is healed, and any destroyed hearts regenerate. And the only way then to actually kill the Trimocratus is to destroy all four hearts.
So it's basically getting 400 HP.
With the same AC of 22. So you basically restart the fight, but now you have to target individual hearts. And in addition, there are now these additional mythic actions, which it could use along with its legendary actions. Rampage, the Trimocratus makes two attacks, one of its tail and one of its tentacle grasp, or Coral Growth, which costs two actions. Each creature within 10 feet must succeed on a DC 25 dex saving throw, or take 3d8 slashing damage, and failed half as much on a success. And until the start of its next turn, the Trimocratus and its hearts gain a +2 bonus to AC. So you get to redo the fight, and now it's harder.
Yeah. Now it's harder, it has more stuff to do, it's going to, it doesn't hit harder, but it hits more often with its rampage ability. Mm-hmm. It's, even taking away this is hard. It's a very difficult fight. But I would like to just point out and applaud the idea of these four hearts. I think this is probably one of the coolest boss fights in an official Wizards of the Coast book I have ever seen. I love that concept of the hearts popping out, and now you have to target these individually, and it is a good way of making it feel like, yes, you're just fighting this thing again, but it just seems really interesting to me. It's a great mechanic.
Right.
This is a situation where you really do have to put the effort in and set up the battlefield so that this stuff it's a thing. You create your gargantuan monstrosity where if you want to go hit the one on its tail, you got to go to the tail and hit it. That's part of the challenge.
That's a great point. And if you're using minis, it might be a matter of just put a post-it note where the heart is. It doesn't matter how you do it. But, just make sure that everybody knows that this isn't just you can hit every heart from wherever you're standing. It becomes part of the battlefield.
Yeah.
I think it specifically says two on its chest, one on its back, and one at the base of its tail.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're like facing it dead on, it's like, great, you can see the two on its chest. If you're facing it in the back, probably can see the tail one, can most likely see the one on its back. Kind of up to your discretion as to how to specifically run it. But this isn't the type of creature that I as a player would want to have to maneuver around. I want to be in my safe position and stay there. But this forces you to get there.
This is actually, this is what, there was some flavor book that was talking about on monster fights where the monster is so big it is the battlefield. And like this stage almost seems like that would make sense for it.
To some extent, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Look at the picture.
It's huge.
It is bigger than a house. You're the barbarian. You want to hit it in its back.
Oh, okay. No, you're right. You're right. So you have to climb on it, you're saying. It's not a matter of like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm with you.
And I think that adds to the mythicness of the encounter, personally.
Right.
But you just have to be prepared as a DM to be like, all right, here's the rules for running around on the back of this thing. Here's the general dimensions. You know, and it fits perfectly with the coral growth because you're like right there. You're going to get hit by that a bunch. That's how it would get things off its back.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. No, that's a great point.
Yeah. Yeah, it starts to give a real Shadow of the Colossus vibes.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, you're going to have to climb this thing up, and obviously, as the DM, you should probably come up with skill challenges and stuff to actually be able to do that and try and time it for when it tries to slam down its pincer, its tentacle, and you avoid it, and now you could run up it and shit like that, and to get to its weak points and then beat the shit out of it until you get thrown off, and then someone else has to do it.
Or somebody casts Fly.
Or the wizard casts Fly.
Which is totally fine.
That's less cool.
It is less cool, but it's also like, you know, how else are you going to
expect
it? Yeah, like,
yeah,
it totally depends on party composition, but you know, whatever resources the PCs have at their disposal are going to need to be used on this in order to win.
Yeah,
you mean like just a flying carpet and acid splash?
Yes.
Still no ranged attack. What? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, this one, and we talked a lot about that issue on the Tarrasque episode that we did, and this one does, you're right, Will, has that same issue, but in its lore, it's specifically described, this thing is going to come upon a coastal city and absolutely decimate it. It is going to take somebody many, many rounds to burn through 800 HP while this thing just levels the whole city.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is it has somewhere to go. Everyone's ridiculously pedantic interpretation is like, you just follow the Tarrasque and he has like nowhere to go. He just walks around. That's all he does. He goes to sleep. It takes you like days, but you'll eventually get him. This guy, he can just swim back
right
to the bottom of the
right
ocean.
He's like, no, you fight me like real adventurers or I'm going back to the ocean.
Roar, stop choosing the battle.
I put a lot of work into this.
And he's got 22 int. He's got 22 int, unlike the Tarrasque, so he'll figure out what you're doing.
And then just throw something at you.
And then just throw something at you. Yeah, I guess. He's got big crab claws, and he's got the tentacle thing. And he does have the ability to throw, which is given with the tentacle grasp. So it's
a much better thing.
They gave him magic weapons, which was another complaint people had about the Tarrasque. Because it is worth noting, this is very much a nerfed Tarrasque with a bunch of extras and a couple of fixes.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So, it's cool.
So, oh boy. So, I remember working this out with the Tarrasque. And just did again. I don't remember the numbers for that one, but for this one, so for Acid Splash, assuming you hit it every time, which you won't, but it does 1d6, so an average of 4 damage. You will get through it in 20 minutes.
Of in-game time.
Yeah, it's
4 damage applied
crazy
every 6 seconds. Ultimately comes out to, yeah, 1,200 seconds. So, yeah, about 20 minutes.
How fun. I love playing the game the way it was intended.
Oh, yeah.
As level 1 adventures.
But, of course, it will pass its saves a bunch. Mm-hmm. What's Acid Splash, a dex saving throw? Yeah, dex saving throw, which actually this thing only does not have any pluses to.
That's why people got so into it, because they're like, this works too well within the rules.
Yeah, but if your save is 13...
800.
It means that it has a 65% chance of succeeding, right? Because it is...
No.
Oh, no, no, less. The other way. Other way, other way.
Of acid splash, yeah.
So it's going to succeed. Not most of the time, but it's going to succeed a pretty good portion of the times.
Yeah. Yeah, it's 800 health divided by an average of 4 damage is 200. So it has to get hit 200 times. I mean, that's, yeah. Easy math.
This is stupid.
And then... Yeah.
Not so mythic now, are you stupid? They did increase the range a lot. Yeah, this is just an improve. This is, it just is night and day. I think they are better at making monsters for the system now than they
definitely
were, you know, half a decade ago. So this, I'm pleased with pretty much everything in this.
Yeah, but to continue the stupid math, so 200 rounds, and then so if only 65% of them hit, it's 307 rounds times 6 seconds a round is 1,800 seconds divided by 60 is 30 minutes.
Yeah, so if you got a half an hour, you can be the guy who slayed the Tremocratus.
Yep, right.
Just by a magic carpet.
Just hope he doesn't pick up a building and throw it at you.
Right, and I would honestly say that if for some reason, which I would not expect people who are level 20 and fighting this thing in a serious setting to try and cheese it, but... picking up a building and throwing it and doing at least that 66 damage is totally fair game.
Mm-hmm. Also, you know, the entire coastal city would get destroyed.
Right.
Oh, nobody gives a shit. These aren't real cities, bro. I just want my experience.
Could you imagine having emotional investment in a tabletop role-playing game?
In fake cities, yeah, right. But the mythic thing also adds to it, in my opinion, where you could say, oh, the heart is exposed, but you got to, like, get within range of its attacks to do anything about it. You know, whereas before you just had to hit any point on the Tarrasque, now you have to hit a specific point, which I think is a great way to deal with some of the cheesier aspects of the game, even if it isn't, you know, a level 4 wizard or whatever doing this shit.
No, okay, so I'm really loving these mythic monsters. I think they're super cool. The fact that there's only 3 in here is a little bit disappointing to me. I really wish now that people would go back and look at the Tarrasque or other major monsters in the Monster Manual across all the other books and turn them into mythic encounters. And lucky for us, somebody did. So next week we'll actually be doing an episode with one of those monsters from Steve Fiddler of Vorpal Dice Press. That's it. He put out a supplement with 36 of these monsters. And we're going to take one and basically do it as our monster of the week. I'm super excited. From what I've seen so far, he did just this. He took these really cool encounters and he made them mythic. So that'll be awesome. Anything else we want to talk about for this episode, though? I think this covers...
No, that has been a long one. We're over 2 hours.
That's how you know it's a good one, Kevin.
Oh, yeah. We're at 2.5, according to my timestamp. After we cut out all the bits of Will just swearing incoherently that we do every episode, we'll probably get down to about 2 hours, so...
Oh, well, if we...
Fucking hate Magic the Gathering settings!
It's just 20 minutes of us...
They tried me to
calming you down. Like, I didn't know we were recording this today. I would have called in sick.
Cool. All right. Thanks for listening.
Next time on Monsters and Multiclass.
Join us as we discuss the Barbarian Cleric and a monster from Mythic Encounters, a supplemental book written by Stephen Fiddler of Vorpal Dice Press. There it is. I got it all out. Perfect. That was too much to say. Don't roll your eyes at me. Nobody listens to this. It doesn't matter. It never matters.